And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and you are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. And folks, on the eve of America's 249th birthday, we are going to be getting into a quintessential discussion for all of you who follow Stomp the Tea out there. Now, I teased this last week, and now is the time to actually have it out. Today's topic on the show, I should say tonight's topic, we're going to be talking about the most dominant athlete in U.S. history. Was it George Herman Ruth, the Babe, or Wilton Norman Chamberlain, Wilt the Stilt? We're going to hash it out. We're going to find out. We're going to talk about it. You're going to make your own decision. I'll give you mine. And of course, we'll also be getting into everyone's favorite segment, What Are You Drinking Tonight? But first, I would like to toss out a couple of bouquets. Congratulations to Clayton Kershaw and to Padraic Harrington on their respective 3,000th strikeout and win at the Senior U.S. Men's U.S. Open golf tournament for the seniors, for Padraic and for Clayton, respectively. Look, I have to say, Clayton Kershaw, he became the 20th pitcher this week to record 3,000 or more strikeouts, and it could not have happened to a more deserving player. Clayton Kershaw, look, he gets knocked for his lack of postseason success, mirroring his regular season success, his regular season dominance. But Clayton's gotten a couple of bad breaks, in my opinion, in the postseason. And for whatever reason, he's never really been able to put it together in the same way that he has during the regular season. But let's not forget, none of that diminishes Clayton Kershaw's absolute brilliance from the mound. He is one of the all-time greats. I'm so happy for him to have actually reached and crossed that 3,000 strikeout threshold. It's something to be very proud of. And again, Clayton Kershaw was a pitcher who had long stretches where he was dominant as any pitcher who's ever played the game. So well done, Clayton. Congratulations to you and your Dodger teammates. I've seen Clayton Kershaw pitch a few times in person, and he was, you know, he has that herky-jerky motion, but boy, oh boy, was he a great pitcher. And he's still pitching, so who knows what's going to happen the rest of this season, but he was one of the best I've ever seen. So congratulations, Clayton Kershaw. And of course, to Padraic Harrington. Paddy, one of my favorite golfers of all time. Padraic won the U.S. Men's Senior Open that was played at Broadmoor, the Broadmoor course out in Colorado. A course I've always wanted to play, actually. It looks like a ton of fun. I mean, major elevation, lots of room out there, but still tricky. If I ever get to Colorado with enough time on the ground, I want to make sure I bring my sticks and play that course. It looks like a great, great course. But anyway, he was in a dogfight with Stuart Sink, and Paddy ended up winning by one stroke. Now, I did not see this. I just heard about this. But I recorded it because I wanted to see that course again. I'm a big fan of the Broadmoor course. And I'm going to be watching that along with the French Open finals. Boy, my list continues to grow. I got to start watching stuff in real time. But happy for Padraic Harrington. He was always gritty. He always gave as well as he got. He was always a very gutty, competitive golfer. And this Open as a senior, U.S. Open, really for him to add to his PGA Championship and his British Open, could not have happened to a nicer guy as well. I'm a big, big Padraic Harrington fan. And congratulations to you, Padraic. You continue to roll along with more success and continue to do that. So congratulations. All right. You know, this week has been a whirlwind, because if you follow the NBA, the draft is behind us, and this was free agency galore this past week. But I did start to think about the fact that the Western Conference in the NBA has been so dominant for years now, essentially since, if you take the Golden State Warriors and their run out of it, I think the Warriors played in five NBA finals straight, I think six overall. I think their last championship of that run was 2019. So from like 2019 onward, we're in 2025 now. I think you've had a different Western Conference team win a championship. Okay, parity, that's fine. But if you look at the strength of the conference, top to bottom, it has just been incredibly difficult. I mean, now some people talk about the AFC in the Mahomes era, right? Where you have Buffalo and Baltimore and the Chiefs and Cincinnati, if you want to throw them in there. Yes, competitive. I get it. True. Sometimes you think about the AFC during the Brady Manning era, where, you know, you had these two heavyweight teams. You throw in Baltimore, you throw in Tennessee every once in a while, you throw in the Steelers. And I think that was pretty much it. So a lot of these conferences, in my opinion, tended to be top heavy, whereas the West kind of top seed all the way down to the 9th, 10th play-in seed since 2019 has been just a murderer's row. But I did find, in my opinion, what would be a parallel. If you look at the NFC conference in football from 1984 to 1996, the NFC did win 13 Super Bowls in a row, if I have my math correct. And that is a murderer's row of competition, because the NFC not only had the San Francisco 49ers, you had the Chicago Bears, you had the Green Bay Packers slipping in there for a couple of Super Bowl appearances and won a win. You had the Giants, you had the then Washington Redskins, you had the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, from 1984 to 1996, the NFC, pound for pound, was probably about as tough a conference as any conference you have ever seen. That includes the modern Western Conference in the NBA today. So I wanted to make that comparison, answer the question for myself. Folks, I have to tell you, a few weeks ago, we reviewed a whiskey in the What Are You Drinking Tonight segment. And it was called Tire Fire. I'm going to show you the bottle. This is Tire Fire. Now, it is distilled by an outfit called, I think it's ASW. Yes, ASW. It's a distillery down in Atlanta. And we talked about this bottle and this product during the, I think, the episode where we talk about Tiger's five greatest majors, right? So you should go back and listen to that. It was a very good episode, by the way. You should go back and listen to it. But you can listen to the review of this whiskey. And one of the things that I noted is that it is so smoky that I think I would have trouble drinking it neat on a regular basis. I even made the point that bottle might last me through the fall, simply because I don't know how I can drink it. I mean, maybe I'll try it in a highball and see if that works, but it is so smoky that it was not something I was going to run through rapidly. Well, folks, I do have some good news for all of you. I've often talked about the fact that if you have a whiskey that you're not particularly fond of neat, throw it in a highball. You know, use it for a cocktail, you know, a Manhattan, an old fashioned, whatever. Folks, this tire fire, which is again smoke in a glass to me, has been a wonderful splash ingredient in cocktails. Guys, I'm telling you, I toss this in I'll have a whiskey and lemonade, toss in a little splash at the tire fire. I'll have a rum and ginger, toss in a little splash of the tire fire. I'll have even a gin and tonic, right? The classic summer drink. Toss in a very little splash of tire fire, and it gives whatever cocktail I'm having a smokiness that, used in the right proportion, really, really enhances the cocktail itself. It makes it almost like a specialty cocktail. Folks, I like tire fire as a splash ingredient for a cocktail so much, I'm actually gonna buy another bottle or two just so I have it around. So again, proof. Whenever you have whiskey, you can always find a use for it. You just have to experiment with it. Tire fire, it's been awesome. Now, folks, before we get into the program, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you to like, subscribe, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your enemies how much you like, love, enjoy the Stomp the Tea podcast. We are here for you week in, week out, and we will continue to bring you content that you cannot get anywhere else, period. So, Stomp the Tea, spread the word. And with that, we are going to get into tonight's show. Folks, who is the most dominant athlete in American history? By the time you guys see this, it will be the 4th of July. And I believe America is turning 249 years old on this 4th of July. So, you know, living here in Philadelphia, we have the Sesquicentennial that will be coming up next year. It's going to be marking the 250th year of the birth of America. And there are big celebrations planned. So what is more American than baseball in Philadelphia? George Herman Ruth, Babe Ruth. Let's start with, in my opinion, and I think in most people's opinion, the incumbent. I'm going to give you some information about George Ruth. I'm sorry. I'm going to give you some information about Babe Ruth. And we're going to sift through this comparison together. Now, before we get started, I do want to acknowledge the fact that comparing Babe Ruth to Wilt Chamberlain is not exactly an apples to apples comparison. I get that, right? Both men, as dominant as they were, played different sports. And baseball to basketball doesn't necessarily translate that cleanly. But I will say this. A lot of this is going to come down to your perspective of the athletes themselves. Now, we can get some guidance by looking at the numbers, and they can help lend us perspective and context. But essentially, your own ideas about these athletes and some of the anecdotal evidence you've picked up over the years is really what's going to guide your choice and your decision. I will tell you mine at the end of this. Now, Babe Ruth. Most of us know the numbers already, all right? 714 home runs, 2,214 RBIs, 2,174 runs scored, 2,062 walks, and a career 342 batting average. That's how Babe Ruth ended his 22-year playing career. Folks, Babe Ruth was a seven-time world champion. He won three World Series with the Red Sox, and he won four with the New York Yankees. Now, Babe Ruth appeared in 10 World Series. What was his record? Obviously, you know, he won seven, so that means he was 7-3 in the World Series. Very good record. In 41 World Series games, He hit 15 home runs and had a batting average of 326. Folks, as we all know, Babe Ruth was a tremendous player. Again, in many people's minds, the greatest baseball player of all time. Let me tell you a little more about his stats. Babe Ruth hit 30 or more homers in 13 of his 22 seasons. He hit 40 or more homers 7 times. And he hit 50 or more homers. Listen to what I'm saying. Babe Ruth hit 50 or more homers 4 times in his career. I mean, obviously, he set the record that stood for a few decades where he hit 60 home runs in a season. I think he had 58 or 59 a season or two before. It is just kind of remarkable the dominance that Babe Ruth displayed for season after season throughout the vast majority of his career. But this is where most people who go with Babe Ruth really make their bread and butter. Let's talk about the pitching. Look, we all know Babe Ruth started out as a pitcher. Most of us do. But very few of us, I think, are familiar with some of the numbers that he put up as a pitcher. We're so much more familiar with the 714 home runs. Let me give you a couple of stats that you might find interesting about Babe Ruth as a pitcher. Now, Ruth pitched 5 seasons as a starter. He appeared in games as a pitcher 10 seasons overall, but he really spent just 5 seasons essentially as a starter, as a pitcher. His career record was 94-46. Folks, that's a 671 winning percentage. His career ERA was 2.34. Now, keep in mind, Babe Ruth pitched over 1,200 innings. So that's a very decent sample size. Now, in 1916, when Babe Ruth was 21 years old, his season as a pitcher, he went 23-12, and he led the league in ERA with 1.75 ERA, games started 40, and he led the league in shutouts that year, 1916, with 9 shutouts as a 21-year-old pitcher. Wow. It's very impressive. The following season, 1917, obviously as a 22-year-old, Babe went 24-13 with a 2.01 ERA. He had 38 starts and 35. 35 complete games. No wonder they took him off the mound and said, "Hey, big fella, grab this bat. You're going to throw your arm off." He had 38 starts and 35 complete games. That's unbelievable to me. Now, as we alluded to earlier, as a hitter, Babe was very, very, very good. I mean, obviously, one of the best ever, if not the best ever, both in the regular season and in the postseason. What did he do as a pitcher in the postseason? Well, Babe was 3-0 in World Series starts, and he only started 3 World Series games in 1916 and in 1918, total. His ERA in the World Series as a pitcher was 0.87. Now you say, okay, fine. That's fine if you're throwing 1 or 2 innings. How many World Series innings did Babe Ruth throw as a pitcher? 31 is the answer. He pitched 31 innings in the World Series, and out of those 3 starts, he had 2 complete games and 1 shutout. Now, in 1916, game 2 of the World Series, Ruth's 14-inning win is still, to this day, 2025, the longest pitching outing in baseball postseason history. Think about it, folks. Babe Ruth, from what I understand, held the postseason home run record forever. Forever means I think Mickey Mantle broke it in the 60s. And he still, to this day, holds the record for the longest postseason pitching outing. And he won the game. Unbelievable. When Ruth retired in 1935, he held or shared 76 records, based off of what I found. Apparently, 56 of those records were held outright by Babe Ruth. And it's pretty hard to believe. As dominant as he was, Babe Ruth just shattered record after record after record after record. Now, Ruth led the AL in home runs 12 times. He led it the AL in slugging percentage 13 times. He led the AL and or league. This was kind of hard to find out. So when I say he led the AL, usually it was the American League, but he may have also led the major leagues in some of these categories, right? So he led the AL in home runs 12 times in his 22-year career. He led the AL AL in slugging percentage 13 times in his 22-year career. He led the AL in walks 11 times, on base percentage 10 times, runs scored 8 times, and RBI 5 times. Now, it's very strange to me. Babe Ruth led the league in home runs 12 times, but only led the league in RBIs 5 times. Two things come to mind. There must have been some unbelievable hitters also driving in runs. Thing number one. Thing number two is maybe Babe was up at the plate with very few men on base, if any, and he's just hitting home runs left and right, so he couldn't get any RBIs outside of himself. Who knows? The strange anomaly about Babe Ruth, and it is strange, but there is an explanation. Babe Ruth only won one MVP during his entire career. One. There is a reason for that, folks. And I'm going to read this so I get this accurate. The MVP award, as we know it today, wasn't established until 1931. Now remember, Babe retired in 1935, 22-year career. So as you can see, the vast majority of his career was played before the modern version of the MVP was even created. Well, before it was ever awarded consistently. There was an MVP award that he won. His MVP award was in 1923, but there was no MVP award at all in the first 7 seasons of his career. And AL players weren't eligible to win the award more than once from 1922 to 1928. Again, I believe Babe won his MVP in 1923. So the problem is, if you're Babe Ruth, you win an MVP on a very good year, but it's not even one of your best years, and you're not allowed to win it again. For some reason, they had this rule. I have no idea why. Now, to the challenger, Wilton Norman Chamberlain of Philadelphia. Folks, let's dig into it. Wilt played 14 seasons. He was a 4-time MVP, 2-time world champion. Wilt scored 31,419 points. He had 4,643 assists. He had 23,924 rebounds. That is still, folks, to this day, the record in professional basketball. And he played 48. He averaged 45.8 minutes a game Again, still an all-time record in the NBA. I said professional basketball before, but these are NBA records. I have no idea what they're doing in Europe or China or where, whatever, Italy, whatever other league. Think about that, folks. 45.8 minutes per game over a 14-year career. Wilt, there are only 48 minutes in a basketball game. So Wilt was on the floor all the time. I mean, he was such an Iron Man. He was such a warrior. So Wilt Chamberlain was a 7-time scoring champ, an 11-time rebounding champ, with career averages of 30 points a game and 23 rebounds a game. Folks, this is what happened when you roll the ball out and Wilt Chamberlain was in the lineup. He averaged 30 and 23. Unbelievable. In the postseason, Wilt Chamberlain averaged 47.2 minutes a game. Again, don't tell me Wilt taps out. Don't tell me Wilt was soft. He's playing almost every minute of every game in his postseason career. His average was 47.2. Wilt Chamberlain was a beast. I'm telling you, that's an all-time record also. 47.2 minutes per postseason game as an average. That's a record. Still stands to this day. For the postseason, Wilt averaged 24.5 rebounds a game. But, and here is the knock, he only, and I say only, because it's true, Wilt Chamberlain only averaged for his postseason career 22.5 points a game. Very strange. Very strange. I know the postseason is different and this, that, and the other. Even in the 50s, even in the 60s, Wilt came in, I think he was a rookie in 1959. Even in the 70s, I know the postseason is different, but I looked at some of the stats and he scored so much more consistently earlier in his career, obviously. But to have a postseason average of 22 points a game and a career average of 30 points a game, a little strange to me. Now, let's give you another comparison. Wilt averaged 20 points or more 12 of his 14 seasons. He averaged 25 points or more 10 of his 14 seasons. Wilt averaged 30 points or more a game his first 9 seasons in the NBA. He averaged 35 points or more a game for 6 seasons. And look, Wilt Chamberlain averaged 40 points or more per game twice in a season. And he did this back-to-back seasons, including his 1961-1962 campaign, where Wilt averaged 50.4 points a game and 25.7 rebounds a game. Again, 1961-1962 season, that was his third year in the league. Now, we talked last week, folks, about how Wilt Chamberlain was the first and for a decade and a half, the only player to ever win Rookie of the Year and MVP of the league, averaging 38 points a game as a rookie. Unbelievable. The man averaged 50 points a game and 25, 26 rebounds a game in his third year in the NBA. What did he do the next season? Oh, he followed it up by averaging 44 points a game. I mean, this is Wilt Chamberlain, folks. This is why we talk about him. At his retirement, some people say, again, this is hard to find some of this information, but some people say Wilt held 72 records, held or shared 72 records. And surprisingly, they say that he held 56 records on his own. I don't know if that's true, but that's the same number that we have for Babe Ruth. Hard to find, hard to research. but that's what I have. Folks, do you know that Wilt Chamberlain scored 65 points or more in a game 15 times? Think about it. 65 points or more 15 times in a game. It's unbelievable. So Wilt's 1961, again, this is his third year in the league. His 1961-62 season, Wilt averaged 48.5 minutes a game. Again, let me remind you folks, a professional basketball game is only 48 minutes. How does Wilt average 48.5 minutes a game for an entire season? Well, I'll tell you how. Wilt played every game, I think, but he also played 10 overtimes during that season. And he only missed, and to me, this is the craziest stat I've ever heard in my life. Wilt Chamberlain, in 1961-1962 season, only missed 8 minutes out of a possible 3,890 minutes played that season. Eight. I mean, that is something like, oh my gosh, I think I wrote this down. It's something like he had, it's the equivalent of 6 seconds rest per game for Wilt Chamberlain during the 1961-1962 season. It's unbelievable. Now, that's the numbers. What do we think of the players? Now, one of the knocks against Babe Ruth is that he never played against any black players during his entire major league career. Obviously, that was not Babe Ruth's fault. You can only play the people in front of you, so on and so forth, da-da-da. I get it, right? Now, in my opinion, I'm just going to give you my opinion, right? Babe Ruth still would have been dominant. I mean, he would have put up some incredible numbers. We just don't know, and we'll never know, whether those numbers would be the same as they are today. Would he have hit 685 home runs instead of 714? I don't know. If Ruth played black players, would he have hit 750 home runs instead of 714? I don't know. There is no way of knowing. That question will never be answered accurately. But that is a knock against Babe Ruth through no doing of his own. Now, I will say this. Again, I think Ruth would have been dominant regardless. I just don't know how his numbers would have changed. Wilt Chamberlain, we have never, ever seen a player like Wilt Chamberlain. I'm telling you right now, folks, when you look at I have no idea what my phone is freaking out. That was weird. If you look at some of the numbers that Wilt put up, it is hard to even imagine what they would look like while you're watching the game. I mean, it would just look like a guy scoring almost every time and getting almost every rebound. It's very, very strange. I think Wilt Chamberlain, to this day, is the most underrated immortal great in the history of sports, literally. Now, again, we talked about how this comparison of Babe Ruth to Wilt Chamberlain is not an apples-to-apples comparison. It's an apples-to-orange comparison. It would be like comparing Wayne Gretzky to Jack Nicklaus, who was more dominant, right? I know. But it's the exercise I chose, and I will give you my answer. Folks, I got to go with Babe Ruth. I just do. I mean, the pitching, it always puts him over the top. I mean, I had no idea how dominant he was as a pitcher in a short span of time. And again, he was so young when he was pitching, 21, 22, 23 years old, and doing these amazing things on the mound. I have to give the nod to Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth, in my opinion, the most dominant athlete in American history. Congratulations. Now, folks, we have come to the part of the show that actually has probably got to be my favorite part of the show, and I'm pretty sure it's one of your favorite parts of the show as well. I get to ask you a question here, and that question is, what are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you what I'm drinking. I am drinking Hill Rock Solera Aged Bourbon. Folks, I'm going to tell you about this product, and I'm going to tell you what I think about this product. Let's go through the numbers. First and foremost, for those of you watching on YouTube, as you can see, this is a gorgeous bottle. Again, if I could only figure out what to do with some of this artisan work, glasswork that some of these companies are putting out, it would be great. I mean, I can't have a bunch of empty whiskey bottles laying around the house. But this is a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous bottle. Folks, it's almost worth the price of admission, just the bottle alone. But let's talk about the contents of said bottle. On the label, it says, this is handcrafted. This handcrafted Solera aged and bottled by Hill Rock Estate Distillery in Ancrum, New York, which is in New York's Hudson Valley. The proof on this, the ABV, it is 46.3% ABV, which makes it 92.6 proof. And I got this particular bottle for $90. There is no age statement on the contents. Now, Solera aged. What does that mean? Solera aging is kind of it's a process. And in some ways, it's, from what I understand, it's comparable to sourdough starter and things of that nature. I'm going to read to you Hill Rock's description, partial description of Solera aging, and you'll see what you think. It says, Solera aging involves a pyramid of barrels where a small portion of whiskey is removed periodically from the lowest tier of barrels and an equal measure of new whiskey is added to the top barrels. No barrel in the Solera is ever emptied. And over time, the older whiskey in the Solera mingles with younger whiskeys to create unmatched depth and complexity. So there it is. Basically, they age this whiskey and they finish the whiskey in, I think, Oloroso sherry barrels, but they don't empty the barrels fully. So there is essentially backwash whiskey from 2, 3, 8, 10, 12, 20 batches ago, mixing with new whiskey that they put in there to finish aging. And that is part of the Solera aging process. So what do I think of it? Well, I mean, when I nose it, when I smell it, I get vanilla, caramel, brown sugar. I have to tell you, it does have, in my opinion, a brilliant depth of flavor. It's light. There's almost zero burn. Look, at what is it, 92.6 proof? It probably shouldn't burn very much. But I will say this. Even when you drink it neat, which I often do. This is the perfect bourbon to introduce to a novice bourbon drinker, and you want to try to convince them to drink bourbon neat. This is what you introduce them to. Now, again, this is $90 a bottle. Most places you're going to find it is probably going to be around $100 a bottle. But if you want to kind of bring someone along the bourbon experience, introduce them to the Hill Rocks Lera Aged Bourbon and let them have it neat, because it's not going to hurt them. It's not going to burn. It's not going to be harsh going down. It's actually full of nuanced flavor. And I think you're going to create a bourbon whiskey lover if this is what you introduce them to. It's well balanced. The pricing, again, it's $90 a bottle. I got it for $90. It's probably around $100 if I tried to find it again. Pricing is about right. And I got to tell you, it is so light. It doesn't hurt you, but yet you still feel a little ebullience. It's perfect for summer. It's absolutely perfect for summer. Now, tomorrow at some point, I'm going to have some of this Hill Rock Solera Aged Bourbon with a cigar. I think it's not going to be raining here on the East Coast and for the day. And I'm going to try that tomorrow. I will report back my findings. But for now, that is the show. Folks, thank you so much for joining us. My name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. I want to thank you for watching. I want to thank you for listening. And as always, we'll see you on the first tee. Happy birthday, America.